This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, an hour-length dramatization of William Faulkner's tragic novel, The Wild Palm. The Wild Palms is one of the few William Faulkner novels which departs the time and place of the main body of his work. But it is very good Faulkner indeed, containing some of his most brilliant and terrifying passages. A story of two lovers, doomed as inevitably and almost as poetically as Romeo and Juliet. We bring it to you today in an adaptation for radio by Richard E. Davis of NBC. And as intermission, we bring you a recorded commentary on the works of William Faulkner by a brilliant fellow novelist, Robert Penn Warren, whose book, All the King's Men, has this year been made into a truly magnificent motion picture. Here now is The Wild Palms by William Faulkner.
The Mississippi sky was overcast. The dark sea wind blew strong and steady and filled the air with the dry, harsh flashing of palm fronds. The wind hissed through the shack, which, weathered and warped by the damp, soft air, leaked all privacy in the manner of broken socks and trousers. On the beach before the shack, there was a new beach chair where the woman sat, dark-haired, doing nothing in a pair of faded jean pants and canvas shoes, with queer, hard, yellow eyes in a face whose skin was drawn thin, at first sullen and later afraid, not reading, not doing anything, just sitting there while the man, who was young, too, and dressed in a pair of khaki slacks and a sleeveless jersey undershirt, sat beside her.
What time is it, Harry?
Almost supper time.
It seems later. The sky has turned so dark.
You want to go in now?
No. I think I'll sit out here a while longer. I'm hurting.
You've got to hurt, Charlotte. It's the pain that you've got to hold on to keep alive. Hang on to the hurt and you'll be all right. Or don't slip away, darling.
Oh, let's not kid ourselves. I've had my day of defiance. Now I've got to pay up. I'm only holding on so you can get out of here before they come.
No, Charlotte, it's still us.
There is no more us here. Pretty soon the hurt's going to get too big. And that's when I won't be able to hold on. And then there's just going to be you.
I'll get a doctor.
No. Get away from here and stay away. You promised me.
Let me get a doctor. The landlord in the next shack, he's a doctor. He'll know what to do.
He'll know that there's been an illegal operation, Harry. And he'll know that you're to blame.
He looks like a kind man. I noticed that when he brought over the gumbo his wife made for us.
A small town doctor with a good busybody wife.
Oh. Don't faint, Charlotte. Don't faint. You've got to hold on.
More gumbo, Doctor?
Why, thank you, Martha. Don't mind if I do. I do declare you make the best gumbo in Mississippi. I hope our tenants next door appreciate what you sent over to them.
The way they're living beats me. That woman, sitting all day in that beach chair. What do you think makes her sit like that all day?
I think she's been hurt deep. Never in my life have I seen so much hate for the race of man in a woman's eyes.
Then what did she come down here with him for if she hates him?
She don't hate him. She hates the race of man. Masculine.
I thought you said she didn't talk.
She didn't talk with me. But I see the way she's listening. She's listening the way people do when they listen to an organ die deep inside themselves. They listen to the beat, their flag maybe. Go up and down, and up and down. and then finally died.
Doctor! Doctor, open up! Open up!
That sounds like the fellow in the shack.
Doctor!
I told you she was hurt.
More likely she's cut or shot him.
Doctor!
I'm coming. I don't know what's been going on over there, but something tells me it isn't going to be pretty. Now, you hold her head. Can you do that?
Yes, yes, I can do that. All of a sudden, she got worse.
Well, that'll happen with this kind of a case. I'll see if this ammonia will help. That's it, girl. I think we can keep her alive till the ambulance gets here.
Do you think she'll live?
Does she want to live?
I don't know.
You're her husband, aren't you?
Not the way you mean.
But you told me when you rented this place that you were Mr. and Mrs. Who is this woman, anyway?
Mrs. Charlotte Rittenmeyer.
And who does that make you?
Harry Wilburn is my name. Dr. Wilburn.
You a doctor. Then, are you the man who treated this woman?
Yes, yes, I did it, I did it.
But what you did was illegal. Against the law of man and God.
I know it, I know it. But she didn't want the baby.
Just don't try to leave her. You're going to have a lot of explaining to do when the ambulance gets here and I turn you over to the deputy sheriff. You're going to have a lot of talking to do.
Explaining? How can it be explained, any of it? It all began on the night of my 27th birthday. I had 2 months to go to finish out my internship in a New Orleans hospital. I was lying on my cot, thinking of the years I had dedicated to poverty.
Dr. George, report to Ward 3. Dr. George, report to Ward 3.
As I lay on my cot, I looked down toward my foreshortened feet, and it seemed to me that I saw there the 27 irrevocable years diminished and foreshortened beyond them in turn, as though my life were to lie passively on my back. As though I floated effortless and without volition upon an unreturning stream. I seemed to see the empty years in which my youth had vanished. The years for wild oats and daring. For the passionate, ephemeral love of adolescence which had not been for me. This I was thinking with that peace with which a middle-aged eunuch might look back upon the dead time before his alteration. At the fading and edgeless shape which now inhabited only memory.
Hi, Harry.
Oh, hello, Flint.
This telegram came for you down at the desk. Here.
Thanks. Well, it's from my sister. She wishes me happy birthday.
Well, the same for me, Harry. You celebrating tonight?
No. I think I'll stay in.
No date again? Not even on your birthday? What's the matter? Don't you believe in fun, Harry?
Well, to tell you the truth, Flint, I've been so darn busy, I don't know anybody, a girl, that is, I could call up for a date.
Then why not come along with me? I'm going to a party. A real party, down in Frenchtown.
That's nice of you, Flint, but nobody invited me.
Oh, it's not that kind of a party. All there'll be is a mob sitting around on the floor drinking homemade gin.
I've got no dress clothes.
Well, your host will probably be wearing a bathrobe. But if you want a tux, I'll borrow you one. We'll be the two fanciest dams at the whole darn party.
All right. Why not, Flint? Why not? Is this the place?
Yeah, this is it, all right. Listen to him. I'll ring the bell.
Yeah, I hope this suit looks okay. I never wore one before.
Harry, sometimes you sound like you've never even been to a party before.
To tell the truth, Flint, this is the first time in all my 27 years I ever was at a real party.
Well, I'll be.
What do I do?
Just find yourself a woman and leave the rest up to her. There's so many things that come natural to a woman that a man just has to learn.
That's just it, Flint. I've never learned anything except, you know, medical books. What do I do?
Well, the first thing, you go over and stand in front of one of the pictures. This place is filled with modern pictures. Somebody will come along with an idea.
Come on in, fellas.
Here you go, Harry.
Look, everybody, it's Gerald Flint and the pal in boiled shirt.
Where's Gerald, boy?
Now listen, boys and girls. This here is Dr. Wilburn. Watch him. He's got a pad of blank checks in his pocket and a scalpel in his sleeve.
If that's true, Dr. Wilburn, I'd like to have a consultation with you. Private.
Come along, Viola. The doctor's too young for you.
Oh, I like that.
What do I do?
The pictures, like I said. One picture worth a thousand words. Good luck, kid.
Having trouble making up your mind about that picture, Dr. Wilburn?
I beg your pardon?
That picture you've been staring at. How do you like it?
She was standing beside me. She wasn't beautiful at first glance. She was a young woman and a good deal shorter than I. And for a moment I thought she was fat. Until I saw it was not fat at all. But merely the broad, simple, profoundly delicate and feminine articulation of Arabian mares. A woman under 25 in a print cotton dress. A face which laid no claim to even prettiness. And wore no makeup save the painted broad mouth. With a faint inch-long scar on one cheek which I recognized as an old burn. Doubtless from childhood.
Having trouble making up your mind about that picture, Dr. Wilburn?
Well, it's a very unusual picture.
Charlotte's my name. Charlotte Rittenmeyer.
It's a pleasure, ma'am.
Thank you.
What do you think of the picture?
Marshmallows with horseradish. I paint, too, though I prefer to sculpt.
Oh, a lady artist.
An artist, anyway. And I can beat that thing hanging there. Feel here my palm. It's a sculptor's palm.
Strong. Like a man.
That's because I work a lot in clay. And brass, too.
That sounds very interesting. What do you make?
Oh, I make things you can touch, pick up. Something with weight in your hand. Not poking at a piece of cloth with a knife or a brush like you were trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle with a rotten switch through the bars of a cage.
You talk like a man, too.
Well, I'm not. But I know a lot about men.
You sound very sure when you say that.
That's because all of my family were brothers except me. I like my oldest brother best, but... Well, you can't marry your brother, and he and Rittenmeyer roomed together in school, so I married Rittenmeyer, and now I have two little girls.
Oh, I didn't know you were...
That I was married.
Uh-huh.
Would it have made any difference?
Well, no, I guess not. I was just hoping that you weren't, that's all.
You aren't married.
Oh, golly, no.
Well, that's something to be thankful for. Not that I'd care either.
What's your husband like?
Oh, his nickname's Rat. What's really important to him is that everybody calls him Rat. Rat's the nickname they give freshmen at the University of Alabama. That's his school. And my husband is the senior living ex-freshman of the University of Alabama. By the way... Are you slumming?
I don't know what you mean.
That dress suit.
Oh. Well, you see, this is my birthday.
Oh.
And this is the first time I ever had a dress suit on.
Well, happy birthday, Harry.
Thanks. I'm 27 years old.
I'll drink to that. You have had a drink before.
Oh, I know all about alcohol. The technical side. I've performed experiments with mice.
So you know how it is with mice. But you don't know how it is with yourself.
I guess that's about the size of it with a lot of things for me. See, most of my life has been spent in books reading other people's answers.
Well, good morning, Dr. Wilbur.
Oh, hello, Flint. It was a good party.
Welcome back among the living. Come 4 a.m., I was getting worried about you.
Oh, I got along all right.
I can see that. Hmm? Wipe the lipstick off your nose.
Huh?
Yeah, where'd you two get to, anyway?
Oh, we just went out in the garden. There was a big jasmine bush out there.
Oh, you just went out in the garden. She's got a husband, Jack.
I know that.
And kids.
She told me all about that.
Did she, tell you what happens to country boys who get mixed up with married women, with husbands, and a couple of kids?
I know what you're thinking, Flint. But she's different.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all different. That's why it's so much fun. Sounds to me like you've got it bad.
Maybe I have, Flint. Maybe I have. I'm going to see her again today for lunch.
Uh-oh.
Twenty-seven years I had gone without love. And then there was this. For the next few weeks, we went for lunch in one of those little French cafes in the Vieux Carré in New Orleans, where you could eat on the $2 I was supposed to send each week to my sister back in Oklahoma.
Harry.
Hmm?
Harry, what are we going to do about this?
Well, what can we do?
Oh, don't let's kid ourselves. For weeks, we've known that sooner or later we were going to have to figure out what we were going to do.
I don't know, Charlotte. I was never in love before.
I've been. But I don't know either. Harry, I told Rat.
Told him?
About these lunches and about how I've been meeting you.
I suppose he was angry.
No. No, but he said no divorce and he means it. I even offered him ground.
Charlotte.
Well, what else could I do? Wouldn't it have been worth it? Yeah, but he said no soap.
If he had, what would it have done to your children?
I wasn't thinking of them. I mean, I've already thought of them, so now I don't need to think of them anymore because I know the answer to that. And I know I can't change that answer. And I don't think I can change me. Because the second time I ever saw you, I learned what I'd read in books, but I had never actually believed. That love and suffering are the same thing, and that the value of love is the sum of what you have to pay for it. And any time you get it cheap, you've cheated yourself. So I don't need to think about the children. I settled that a long time ago. I was thinking about money.
Charlotte, I haven't got a cent. If I did, we could go out to Chicago. For 2 years, ever since I came to the hospital, every week for 2 years, I've been sending my sister a money order for $2 and no cents. And to do this, I can't even buy cigarettes.
So that's all of it, huh? The end of us.
I don't know. I'll figure out something.
Listen, tell me again that you haven't got any money. Say it.
Hmm?
Give me something that I can accept as the strong reason we can't beat. Even if I can't believe or understand that it could be just that. Just money and not anything but just money. Come on and say it.
I have no money.
All right. All right, it makes sense. It must make sense. It'll have to make sense. Now you can take me home. No. No, put me in a cab and send me home on my money. You pauper.
The cab went on fast. It disappeared almost at once, although I was not looking after it. The opposite direction was mine. I started walking along the curb, and after a while, I came to a trash bin sitting on the curb edge. And there, resting in the mass of discarded newspapers and fruit skins, was a leather wallet. It held 5 stubs of 5 pari-mutuel tickets from Washington Park, a customer's identification card from a National Gasoline Trust, and another from a BPOE lodge in Longview, Texas, and $1,278 in bills. $1,278! And the next day, we left for Chicago. Rat came to the train with Charlotte. And there we were. The husband and the wife, he in the conservative, unassertive dark suit, the face of a college senior revealing nothing, lending an air of impeccable and formal rightness to the paradoxical act of handing the wife to the lover, almost identical with the mumbo-jumbo of father and bride at a wedding in a church. She stood beside him watching the train slide in with that instinctive proficiency in and rapport for mating even of innocent and unpracticed women. That serene confidence in their amorous destinies like that of birds on their wings. An utter and complete faith in airy and fragile and untried wings. The airy and fragile symbols of love, which in taking flight, they repudiate. The three of us stood at the door of the coach.
Harry,
Rhett's coming with us as far as Hammond.
Go in the coach, Charlotte. Go in and sit down there.
Well, you don't have to push me, Rhett.
Remember now, Charlotte. If I don't hear from you by the 10th of each month, I'm going to give the detective the word.
Yes.
And no lies, see?
Yes.
No lies.
Nothing to lie about, Rhett.
I want to talk to you, Wilburn. You can stay right here on the platform.
Goodbye, Rhett. I'll be in the coach room.
Listen, Wilburn. If any harm comes to her, if you're not on the square with her, I'll know it. If I don't hear from her by the 10th of every month, I'm going to give the detective the word to go ahead. Send him out to Chicago. And I'll know lies, too, see?
I see.
She wouldn't take any money, so here.
What's this?
A cashier's check for $300 payable to the Pullman Company of America. And endorsed, as you'll notice, for one railroad ticket to New Orleans, Louisiana.
I was going to do that with some of my money.
Well, if it's ever cashed and returned to the bank and no ticket bought with it, I'll have you arrested for fraud.
You mean you want her to come back? You'll take her back?
I ought to sock you.
It seemed at that moment that Rat and I both stood aligned in battle, doomed and lost before the entire female principal. I took the check and went to sit beside Charlotte in the coach.
Where are we now, Harry?
On our way to Chicago, Nord.
I mean, the place, this minute.
Oh, on a trestle on the water, away out between Maury Pass and Pontchartrain. A lot of water, all swamp-bound and no horizon in sight.
I love water. That's where to die.
Hmm?
That's where I'd like to die. In the water. Not in the hot air above the hot ground. To wait hours for your blood to get cool enough to let you sleep, and even weeks for your hair to stop growing. The water. The water to cool you quick so that you can sleep. To wash out of your brain and out of your eyes and out of your blood all that you ever saw and thought and felt and denied.
Darling, let's look ahead to the new life we both believe in. Now is the honeymoon.
Oh, listen, it's got to be all honey. Always and forever and ever until one of us dies. It can't be anything else. Either heaven or hell. No comfortable, safe purgatory between for you and me to wait. Wait until good behavior or shame or repentance overtakes us.
So it's not me you believe in, put trust in. It's love. Not just me, any man, and love.
Yes. Yes, it's love. They say love dies between two people. That's wrong. It doesn't die. It just leaves you. It goes away if you aren't good enough or worthy enough. It doesn't die. You're the one that dies.
I've got to get used to love, Charlotte. You've got to give me time. I've never tried it before. You see, I'm 10 years behind myself.
Yes, Harry, but you're getting used to it. You stole the money we've got now. Wouldn't you do it again? Isn't what we've got now worth it? Even if it goes bust tomorrow and we have to spend the whole rest of our lives paying interest?
Yes. Yes, only it's not going to bust tomorrow, nor next month, nor next year.
Nor ever. Not as long as we're worthy of keeping it. Good enough and strong enough. Worthy enough to be allowed to keep it. Keep it. That's what we're going to do, Harry. And that's not a sin. Oh, it can't be a sin.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you Wally Mayer as Harry in a radio version of The Wild Palms by William Faulkner. Now, a word of appreciation from those of us connected with this program to the National Council of Teachers of English, who this year gave their sole annual award to the NBC Theater. In their words, it has been the program which has done most to promote greater understanding and appreciation of our literary heritage, to promote powers of intelligent listening and critical thinking, and to raise the ideals of good speech and writing. And now, our intermission commentator, Robert Penn Warren.
William Faulkner is the author of 18 books, with a 19th announced for publication. This is the fruit of some 30 years of labor. And that body of work will, I imagine, last as long and loom as large as any literary product of our country and this half century. Faulkner has created a world in his fabulous county of Mississippi, where most of his stories are laid, is as solid and real as any area where surveyor lines run and taxes are paid. But Faulkner does not tell us something about Mississippi. Rather, he makes Mississippi tell us something about ourselves. That is the final measure of his achievement. But let us look at some details about achievement. First, there is the powerful evocation of the physical world, a brooding relish and intensity in contemplating the rich texture of that physical world, the pine whining afternoons of August, a dusty road stretching forever across the red clay hills, and a single wagon coming along it, the sinister, moccasin-inhabited, dappled gloom of the forest, and the big river in flood, and little piddling creeks that run backward one day and forward the next, and come busting down on a man full of dead mules and hen houses. Second, there are the people and the stories of this world, the violent, dark, obsessed stories and the violent, dark, obsessed people, the Popeyes and Christmases and Snopeses. But they are also the humorous people and the humorous stories, for Faulkner's a great humorist. And always, there's a group of suffering and good and devoted people. Those people who may be outraged by life, but who keep some hold on justice and goodness and are able to endure. Third, Faulkner's stories and novels are deeply felt and deeply thought. They mean something. In one way, we may say that Faulkner is a critic of our modern world, of its moral confusion and indifference, its materialism, its dehumanizing organization, its worshiping bitch goddess success. And that brings us to our novel today, The Wild Palms. It is a strange novel in that it is composed of two independent stories that seem to be entirely without relation to each other. One is the story of a Mississippi convict who, in the great flood of 1927, is ordered out in a skiff to a rescue and is caught in the flood and borne away. The other story is that of a man and woman who fall in love and are borne away from their safe and respectable lives, much as the poor convict is borne away on the flood. Both stories then are related in that they are stories of the driven and dispossessed, of people outside society, and in both stories we find a triumphant humanity of courage and humor somehow lightening a dark fate.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Our radio version of The Wild Palms will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
When we got to Chicago, Charlotte took over the problem of finding us an apartment. I don't know what it is about women that makes them so efficient in the domiciling of an affair. Not thrift, not husbandry, but something far beyond that. A completely infallible instinct, a completely uncerebrated rapport. And they all believe they can take Lothario himself and trim the very incorrigible bachelor's ringlets which snared them into the seemly decorum of Monday's hash and suburban trains.
Harry! Harry, I found it.
Found what?
An apartment, a studio apartment where I can work, too.
Hey, wait a minute. What is this work, too?
Well, Harry, you don't think that $1,200 will last forever.
Well, we seem to be doing pretty good.
There's always the day of reckoning. And for us, that day comes on the 15th of September. And on that day, we won't have any money left.
I guess maybe you're right. But you see, I'm 10 years behind myself. You just wait till I get used to love. I'll think of something.
Oh, you think a lot, don't you, Harry?
I do. And the fact is... Now, please, please don't laugh at this. But I was thinking that as long as I don't have a license to practice medicine here in Chicago, I might try to do a little writing about some of the things I've been thinking about.
Why, Harry, I think it's wonderful.
Oh, not that I take it seriously, you understand, but I thought... Well, you know they say write about something you know about. So I thought I'd write about love. That was the beginning of our life in Chicago. I rented a typewriter and began writing fiction. True confession stuff, and I sold it. Charlotte began to make little figures which she sold to stores for window displays. Money came in little by little, and we squeaked by the 15th of September that Charlotte had worried about. Cheddar. But then Charlotte got a job decorating in one of the Chicago stores, Days, which left me all alone, Days. And then the Christmas season started. Charlotte began to work nights, evening, that is. And then something happened one night just 2 days before Christmas. Just a minute, I'm coming.
Oh, Harry, help me wave my arms. They're so full of packages, I couldn't reach.
Here, I'll take some of those.
Oh, thanks.
Well, you're home early tonight.
Oh, I simply had to take some time off to do my Christmas shopping and...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there. Oh, that's good. I wondered how long I'd have to wait for a spot of necking for it. How did your day go?
Well, I cranked out 3,000 words from 8 o'clock till sundown. A true epic of confession fiction beginning at 16, I was a mother and a widow.
It sounds great. Oh, it's too bad the publisher won't get it in time to send a check back before Christmas.
Well, when your job gives out after the holidays, we'll need every nickel we can get our hands on.
Ah, but that's it. I have good news.
Hmm?
Mm-hmm. They've offered to keep me on at the store after Christmas, clear through the summer at least. Oh, isn't that wonderful, Harry?
Charlotte, you shouldn't be working like this. Now, I don't mean to come the heavy husband on you, but it's wrong.
Why, for heaven's sake?
Because we're never alone anymore.
You home-wrecking Boy Scout, you. We've always been alone. No two people could be more alone if they tried.
That's not true, Charlotte. Why, with these crazy hours, we never see each other.
Oh, but we will. Honestly, I never in my life saw anybody try as hard to be a husband as you do.
But all we do is sleep and eat.
But that's all other people do.
But never together, never alone together. And that's what we bought when we walked out of New Orleans. What we're paying for, to be together, and that's what must be.
Of course, Harry. That's what we want for us. Well, I'll just tell them to take their old job and give it to somebody else. Somebody who has a husband who doesn't love them as much as mine.
She was a better man than I was. She loved that job. But most of all, she wanted for us to be happy. So she quit the job. And 3 weeks later, I entered a downtown Chicago office building and ascended 20 floors to an opaque glass door lettered Callahan Mines. And there I met a red-faced, cold-eyed man of 50.
You want the doctor's job in our Utah mine, huh?
Yes, Mr. Callahan. And I think I can meet the qualifications. I went 4 years and graduated...
Never mind, lad. Can you take care of the ordinary injuries that men working in a mine shaft might meet?
I was just trying to tell you, sir, that...
I heard you. Listen, you're the man to protect the mine owners as well, the fellows who pay your salary.
I understand, sir.
There'll be no medical inspectors out there to ask to see your license. I want to know if I can count on you to take care of the company first. You know, no lawsuits.
Yes, sir. I can do that.
All right. You leave Chicago tomorrow. The pay is $1,500 in keep.
Well, that's not much, Mr. Callahan. I've got a good degree.
Then you don't want this job. This job is nowhere near up to your qualifications and your deserts. Good day. I said good morning.
If you'll give me transportation for my wife, I'll take the job.
You're wrong, Wilbur. There's a train leaves Chicago for Utah tomorrow night. Be on it.
So we made ready to leave the apartment in Chicago where we had lived all those months. And in our leaving left no other mark of all of our time of living and loving other than cigarette scars on the table. No mark of the worthwhile believing in relationship that we were trying to build. And when the time came to go, a friend came by for us. McCord, a young fellow who knew one of Charlotte's brothers in New Orleans. McCord was one of those pleasant young fellows called good guys. And Charlotte and I liked him very much. He came by in his car and drove us down to the station.
Train number 4, the Mountaineer, leaving for the West on track 17 in 10 minutes.
Well, you two, still time to back out?
McCord, we are not to be tempted by last-minute speeches.
Well, before you folks give yourselves up to the winter in Utah, we still have time for just a drink.
Oh, will you and Harry have one, Mac? I'm no good at farewell.
Charlotte, could I have a kiss from you before you go?
Why, sure, Mac. I'll make it one for the road. Only I'm the one that's going down the road, eh? Goodbye, Mac.
Keep punching, kid.
I'll be along in a couple of minutes, Charlotte. Charlotte took that pretty seriously.
Oh, I'm sorry, Harry.
I didn't mean that. I just wondered what it was with you.
Well, it was that for a second there, I knew I'd never see her again. Oh, how about that drink?
What'll it be, gentlemen?
Ryan Water.
Yes, same for me.
Where was it?
Well, what's eating at you, Mac?
Oh, I wish I knew what it's all about. You're leaving Chicago this way. Here you're making fair money, and Charlotte has a good job. You had a nice place to live in, and then all of a sudden you quit it. Make Charlotte throw up her job and start out in February to live in a mine shaft in Utah.
Listen, Mac. Charlotte taught me a long time ago that the best thing in life was to live for the short time you're alone. Breathe, be alive, and know it.
So, why go all the way to Utah to breathe? What's wrong with Chicago?
We're getting respectable, and we don't like what it's doing to us. It's respectability that makes chiropractors and clerks, bill posters and motormen and pulp writers of us all.
But you were doing all right, Harry.
Mac, I had tied myself hand and foot in a little strip of ink ribbon. Daily, I watched myself getting more and more tangled in it like a roach in a spider web. And all the while, we thought we were going great guns.
And what changed your minds?
I got afraid.
But you had love and money. What was it to be afraid of?
Because money you can't depend on. And there's no place in the world for love today. Mankind has eliminated it. Oh, it took us a long time, but man is limitless and resourceful in inventing, too. And so we've got rid of love at last. Why, if Jesus returned today, we would have to crucify him quick in our own defense to justify and preserve the civilization we have worked and suffered and died and shrieking in rage and impotence and terror for 2,000 years to create and perfect.
So if you know that's true in Chicago, it's true in a forsaken mine shaft.
The city was part of what was being done to us. Living the way we had to, starving would have been nothing. It could have done nothing but kill us. What we had was worse than death or division, even. It was the mausoleum of love and, well, we chose to get out.
But out of the frying pan, what next?
So let the next move be up to them. I am vulnerable in neither money nor respectability now. So they will have to find something else to force us to conform to the pattern of human life, which is now evolved to do without love, to conform or die. So I'm afraid, McCord, because they're smart, shrewd, or they'll have to be. If they were to let us beat them, it would be like unchecked murder and robbery, Mac.
Well, then you can't beat them.
Of course we can't beat them. We're doomed. That's why I'm afraid.
Train number 4. A Mountaineer, leaving for the West in 5 minutes.
Will you give me your blessing?
You can take my curse.
great dirty canyon served as a bed for the mine shaft. On one wall, a half a dozen houses made mostly of sheet iron and window deep in snow clung. The canyon was not wide. It was a ditch, a gutter. It soared, swooping the pristine snow, scarred and blemished by and dwarfing the shaft entrance, the refuse dump, the few buildings. Beyond the canyon rims, the actual unassailable peaks rose. Cloud raveled in some incredible wind on the dirty sky, and the whole had a quietness that was strange.
The Callahan mine looks deserted, Harry.
Well, maybe that's the way mines look.
It's funny the superintendent didn't come down to meet us.
We've come this far. We might as well walk on over to the office and introduce ourselves.
Come in.
Are you the superintendent?
That's right, stranger. Mind closing the door?
Well, what can I do for you, mister?
I'm Dr. Wilburn, and this is my wife, Charlotte.
Pleased to know you. This is Mrs. Buckner.
How'd you do? Hello.
I'm Bill Buckner.
Glad to see you, sir.
You and the missus picked a bad day to travel, didn't you?
Well, Mr. Callahan said he'd get out of here right away.
Callahan? Mm-hmm. You mean he sent you out here?
That's right. He hired me in Chicago.
Well, I'll be... sent you out here. You hear that, Billy?
Well, what's so funny? Oh, it isn't a doctor we need.
I don't understand this. Callahan said you need a doctor because you had a lot of Chinese workmen and...
The Chinese are gone.
And Italian workmen.
Gone, every last one of them. All we got are Poles working night and day to make overtime they're never going to get.
I don't understand.
Tell him, Buck. Don't keep him in suspense. Come on and tell us.
There hasn't been a payroll in here since last September. Callahan mines are broke. Maybe he can hustle up some money now that you're here. I don't know. But it looks to me like the only reason Callahan hired you was to meet examinations by the mine inspectors. In that way, he can keep his mine open and still go on selling stock back in Chicago.
Reach over and turn up the stove, will you, Harry?
Yes, sure. I must have dozed off. What happened to our friends, the Buckners?
They went on up to bed. Oh, Harry, what are we going to do? We can't stay here.
Looks like the question is, when do we get out?
It's got to be soon, Harry.
Well, we can stick it out until we get our bearings, and then shove off again after a couple of months.
It's got to be sooner than that, Harry.
Hmm? What do you mean?
Oh, put your arms around me, Harry. Hold me. Hold me. Well,
what's wrong, Charlotte? What's happened?
Oh, believe me, Harry. I'd give anything if only it hadn't happened. But now it has.
Darling, what are you trying to say?
There's a baby on the way.
Charlotte.
I didn't mean for it to happen.
When? Well, when will it be?
In the summer. It can't be, Harry. I don't want it.
Of course we want it.
No. We choose our lives in the way we live. There can never be any children.
But it'll still be you and I, Charlotte. The baby can't change us.
We don't know. We can't be sure of that, and I don't want it. And you've got to do something about it.
What are you getting at? What are you suggesting?
Call it what you like. You're a doctor, Harry, and there must be something that you can do.
Now, listen. Don't you ever think about that. There are some things a doctor...
Don't be a Boy Scout on me now, Harry.
Now, listen to me, Charlotte. You're upset now, dear. All women are, but they get used to the idea.
I don't want to get used to the idea. And that's why you've got to do something about it.
What you're suggesting is murder.
But it's different. You're a doctor.
No decent doctor in his right mind would listen to what you're suggesting. Oh, Charlotte, darling, we'll go where it's warm, Charlotte. South, you can have the baby.
I've already had two. I don't want this one.
Don't say that.
Children hurt too much, Harry. Not in the being born, but in the living. You've got to do it, Harry.
And finally I did. Because there seemed nothing else to do. I did what Charlotte asked me in the name of our love. But something went wrong. In the great doom-black tent in which we crawled, two people in search of happiness, something went wrong.
I kept my promise to Charlotte and took the life she asked. And in the taking, I marked the one I loved to follow the unlamented, unborn. Charlotte grew weaker and weaker. Knowing, half-guessing, she asked me to take her back to New Orleans so that she might have a chance to say goodbye to Rat and her children. And then we were back in New Orleans where we had started a year before. And once again, Charlotte was standing inside Rittenmeyer's house, and I was waiting outside. She was seeing her children, the ones she had born. Was it for the last time? And once the children were out of the room, Rat would try to reason with her.
Charlotte, listen to me. I tell you, I won't go to the hospital.
But if something's gone wrong, you could die. Maybe you've got, what do they call it? Toxemia, septicemia. You're sick. Go to a hospital.
I can't go to the hospital.
Because you're afraid they'll find out that Harry did it to you and put him in prison for it?
It wasn't his fault.
I won't let them hurt Harry. I'll assume all the blame, tell all the lies. I want to save you, Charlotte.
We're going away. Harry and I are leaving New Orleans.
When?
That soon. We're going to a village on the Mississippi coast.
There are doctors and hospitals here that can help you, Charlotte. Why are you going away?
Sit in the sun until I get better.
What if you don't get better?
Then I'll sit in the sun.
Charlotte, we're almost there. Ah, oh, this sun will be good for you, darling. You'll be all right.
You love me, Harry, a lot, an awful lot.
You know that I do.
Then listen, if we're going to get it.
Get it?
If I don't live, you'll know in time what...
We're not going to get anything. You'll hold out. I've helped you hold out so far, haven't I?
Don't be a fool now. There's no time now. Every minute I get worse. You'll know in time, so get out, do you hear?
Don't talk that
way. Promise me. Don't you know what they'll do to you? You can't lie to anybody, even if you would. And you won't be able to help me if you stay. But you'll know in time. Just telephone an ambulance or the police or something and wire Rat and get out fast. Promise me.
Charlotte.
Harry!
Charlotte! Doctor!
Take it easy there, young fellow. You better keep calm. The deputy will want to talk to you when he comes.
Let him come, but let him come fast. Where's the ambulance? You promised the ambulance would come.
You aren't in New Orleans, son. Little Mississippi towns like this don't have many emergencies of this nature.
The least they could do is hurry. She's suffering so.
You should have thought of that before, son. Before you murdered her.
The siren came, and the ambulance appeared, and the deputy, with the indelible mark of 10,000 Southern deputy sheriffs, the snapped hat brim, the sadistic eyes, the slightly unmistakably bulged coat, the air, not swaggering exactly, but of a formerly pre-absolved brutality, who snapped the handcuffs on my wrist and supervised Charlotte's loading into the ambulance by the intern, who didn't do a thing for her, but
took her name and age and birthday in triplicate and asked me instead of going first to jail, would I like to go to the hospital and wait while the doctors tried to save the life of Rittenmeyer? Charlotte.
Dr. Richardson. Dr. Richardson. Dr. Richardson.
Mister, I wonder how long they're going to work on that little old girl of yours in there.
I don't know, officer.
Every smart man in the hospital's been in that operating room almost since the minute they wheeled her in.
Look, you got a cigarette?
I told you, you can't smoke in here. You know, you hear a lot of funny stories about doctors and nurses. You think they're true about what goes on in hospitals?
They're like the stories you hear about every place else.
Hey, now. Look at this sweet little old nurse.
Mr. Wilburn?
Hi, Mr. Wilburn.
Doctor says I can take you in to see her now, but just for a minute.
You mean in the room?
On the operating table.
Then she didn't live?
Mrs. Rittenmeyer died at 11:03.
Who?
Come on, Jack.
Take him to the dispensary, officer. The doctor says you can give him a drink.
I don't want it.
You better take it, Jack, because over yonder in our little old jail, y'all gonna get some mighty thin lips.
Quiet! Clear, Samuel, then!
Visitor to see you, Wilburn.
Send him down, officer.
He's right down there, Mr. Rittenmeyer.
Hello, Wilburn.
How are you, Rat?
I just came from Charlotte's funeral.
Is that what you came to tell me?
I brought your clothes.
I see you have. Thanks.
I made your bond. They let you out this morning.
Hooray.
And I brought you some money. It's the same $300 I gave you in the check when you and she went away the first time.
I don't want it now any more than I wanted it then.
$300 should get you a long way. I'd say Mexico.
What are you getting at? Jump bail?
Yes. Get away from here. I'll buy you a railroad ticket and send it to you.
I'm sorry.
If you get to New Orleans, you could even ship out on a boat.
I'm sorry.
Think of her.
I wish I could stop. I wish I could.
No. No, I don't. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the reason.
Then think about me.
I wish I could stop that, too.
I feel like...
Not me. Don't feel sorry for me, see?
Rat, maybe I'm sorry because you can't do anything.
You won't go?
Maybe if you could tell me why...
Time's up, Mr. Rittenmeyer.
I'm coming.
You forgot the money.
So you won't do it? You won't?
I'm sorry, Rat. Only if you could just have told me why, maybe I would.
Maybe you'll understand a lot of things a little better, Mr. Rittenmeyer, when the state of Mississippi gets them into court.
How does the prisoner plead?
Guilty, Your Honor.
Is the accused trying to throw himself on the mercy of the court?
I just plead guilty, Your Honor.
Then there is no need for the state to make a case. I will instruct the jury to...
Kill him! Kill him!
Who is that man?
I'm Francis Rittenmeyer, husband of the deceased.
Disarm that man!
I'm not armed.
What's the meaning of this clowning?
If the court please... I would like to say
something. Well, Mr. Rittenmeyer, this case is closed. However, if you still wish to make a statement, you may do so. Step forward, please.
I would like to make a statement. I wish to make a plea for mercy for this man.
You what? You what?
A plea. I would like to make a plea for mercy.
Mercy for this man who willfully and deliberately sent your wife to her death? Quiet! Quiet! I'll clear the court. I'll clear the court. Sit down, Mr. Rittenmeyer. I'll get you protection out of town.
I don't want protection.
Maybe you'll need it. Now sit down. Gentlemen of the jury, you will find the prisoner guilty as charged, and so bring in your verdict, which carries with it a sentence of hard labor in the state penitentiary for a period of not less than 50 years. You may retire.
I reckon there's no need of that, Judge. I reckon we all pretty much...
You will retire. Do you wish to be held in contempt? Retire, even if you come back in 2 minutes.
The Mississippi wind blew soft and dark through the palms that clashed in the dull of early after sundown dusk, bringing with it the smell of swamps and wild jasmine, blowing on under the dying west and the bright star. It was night.
Hello, Wilburn.
Huh? Oh, right. I didn't see you standing there.
The deputy let me in. I brought you something.
Money?
No, a package. A little package. Here, take it.
Rat, you just won't give up, will you? What is this stuff? Cyanide?
50 years is a long time.
I won't use it, Rat. But I thank you. I thank you, Rat.
I'm not doing it for you. I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for her.
And so it is for this that I am living. But while I am, there is memory to think about, forever and inescapable. So long as there is flesh to respond to memory. And if memory exists outside the flesh, it won't be memory, because it won't know what it remembers. So if she became not, then half of memory became not. And if I become not, then all remembering will cease to be. And between grief and nothing, I will take grief.
You have been listening to The Wild Palms, an NBC theater production of the William Faulkner novel. The Wild Palms is available in a Signet book reprint. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC Theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; Washington State College, Pullman, Washington; the University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; or Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. You also have a chance to win a set of the famous Encyclopedia Britannica. Several of the universities and colleges offering these courses are giving the Encyclopedia as prizes to the students doing the best work. Enroll in a supervised course and you may be one of the fortunate ones to win the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, the NBC Theater makes this broadcast time available for a celebration of Human Rights Day by the United Nations that will include the Boston Symphony Orchestra with Leonard Bernstein conducting the world premiere of the United Nations Hymn by Aaron Copland. Be with us again at the NBC Theater on December 18th for the first radio production of Thomas Wolfe's wonderful novel, You Can't Go Home Again. And on Christmas Day for a dramatization of Alice in Wonderland, starring Dinah Shore. The Wild Palms was adapted for the NBC Theater by Richard E. Davis. Wally Mayer was featured as Harry. Lynn Allen was Charlotte. Gloria Ann Simpson was Martha. Jim Nusser was the Doctor. Helen Andrews, the nurse. Glenn Denning was Flint. Ann Diamond was Viola. Tom Charlesworth was Rat. Nestor Piva was Callahan. Clark Gordon was McCord. Shep Mencken, the deputy. And Gain Whitman, narrator. Your announcer, Don Stanley. Our intermission commentator was Robert Penn Warren. His commentary was recorded. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. What's on NBC tonight? Madeline Carroll and Basil Rathbone co-star in the detective melodrama The Amazing Dr. Clitterhouse on Theater Guild on the Air. And for more detective work, remember to tune for Sam Spade today for his most humorous adventure this season. That's two great programs you'll surely want to hear. Sam Spade and Theater Guild, both on NBC. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.